Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment.
This is Rabbi Cosgrove, something a little bit different this week on Park Avenue Podcasts. Pleased to share a recent edition of my teacher podcast, a podcast that my colleague, classmate, and friend, Rabbi Eddie Bernstein, has put together, a celebration of the people who shape our lives. In this podcast, I share the influence and relationship I had with my mentor and teacher, Rabbi Louis Jacobs, who would have turned 100 this week. And also, it gives me an opportunity to reflect on the decisions that led me to becoming a rabbi. Hope you enjoy.
Hello, I'm Rabbi Ed Bernstein. Welcome to the My Teacher Podcast, a celebration of the people who shape our lives. It's my pleasure to be joined today by my friend, colleague, and rabbinical school classmate, Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. Since 2008, he has served as the spiritual leader of Park Avenue Synagogue in New York City. In addition to his rabbinical ordination from the Jewish Theological Seminary, Rabbi Cosgrove earned his PhD at the University of Chicago Divinity School. His dissertation was on the life and work of the great British theologian, Rabbi Louis Jacobs. Rabbi Jacobs died in 2006 after an illustrious career. July 17th, 2020 marks the 100th anniversary of his birth. As we mark the Rabbi Louis Jacobs centennial, I'm honored to discuss his legacy with Rabbi Cosgrove. Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove, welcome to the My Teacher Podcast.
Thank you, Eddie. It's really an honor and a pleasure, and it's great to reconnect, and I'm loving the whole concept behind My Teacher Podcast. It's great to be here.
Thank you. We will soon discuss the legacy of your teacher, Rabbi Jacobs, and his influence on you, but I want to discuss briefly the Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove origin story. So can you talk a little bit about your early life and the foundation that you and others created that paved the way for your spiritual journey to the rabbinate? That's a long-winded way of asking, how did you decide to become a rabbi?
I'm only sorry that I'm drinking a Diet Coke and not a good scotch as you put me in the therapy couch here, Eddie. So let me try to answer your very kind and good opening question by also drawing in a bit of the topic of the day, which is to say that though I'm born and bred in Los Angeles, California, my parents are both immigrants from the UK. My mother is from Manchester, England, and my father is from Glasgow, Scotland. My grandfather, of blessed memory, was a British rabbi, Reverend I.K. Cosgrove, an Orthodox rabbi in Glasgow, where he served the entirety of his career. Now, that's important because my grandfather passed away when I was less than one. I think there's one photograph of the two of us together. I grew up in a household where my father regaled us of what it was to be the child of a congregational rabbi. So in the Elliot Cosgrove story, if you will, there is, you know, nice Jewish boys grew up to be doctors, lawyers, or rabbis. There's no story about when did Elliot find religion, you know, what went wrong. I have one brother who's in the movie business, another brother who works for YouTube. My parents find that more interesting than the fact that I became a rabbi. It was a good job. So I grew up, I got very, very involved in Hillel on campus. I went to University of Michigan. There was a very charismatic Hillel director, a man by the name of Michael Brooks, who took me under his wing. And it was at that moment that I thought for the first time that maybe I would go into Jewish communal work. And now I know that there are a million expressions of Jewish communal service. You can be a social worker, you can be an educator, you can be an administrator. There are a million noble ways to do it, but my biases being what they were, one who wanted to work professionally in the Jewish world, the degree that one sought was a rabbinical ordination. At the same time, I ended up double majoring, actually, and I majored in Jewish studies, and I became very enamored with academic interests at the time, not just serving in the Jewish community, but also scholarship. And so when I came out of JTS, and we were classmates, Eddie, at JTS, those last few years at the Jewish Theological Seminary, I understood, as all our classmates were going out for their first jobs, that I was going to serve not just Jews, but I thought I would become a Jewish studies professor somewhere. And I went off to University of Chicago to get my PhD in modern Jewish thought. Eventually, and maybe we'll get into this over the course of the interview, I realized, well, an advisor of mine once said, Elliot, you have to decide what you love more. Do you love Jews or Judaism? Mm. If you love Judaism, go teach it in a university. If you love Jews, you got to work with them. and so upon completing my PhD, I realized that much as I love Judaism, I love Jews more. And I became a full-time, I was already working part-time at a congregation in Chicago on Shayamet, but I, at that moment of getting my PhD, I threw my hat into the ring and became a congregational rabbi at Park Avenue, and I've never looked back.
I want to go back just for a moment to your grandfather. So you didn't really know him. He died when you were very young, but you were, as you said, you were regaled with stories about him. So to what extent, as you were going through your studies and going on your spiritual path, in what way do you feel that your grandfather was present with you along the way there?
Oh, I think he's present with me always. I think that if I were truly in the therapy couch, my life journey is a quest to get to know the life and the man that I never got to know, my grandfather. And I am deeply aware in my conversations with my father when I'm talking about this issue or that issue of synagogue. I mean, my dad's a doctor. He's not a rabbi, but that when I'm talking to him and he'll sort of tell me, yeah, I remember, you know, when my dad had a problematic board member or this or that, it's a family conversation in my household. So his presence is very much present.
I'm curious, did your grandfather, to your knowledge, know Rabbi Jacobs? And is there a connection between your grandfather being a rabbi in England and your being drawn to one of the great leaders of British Jewry?
Absolutely. Absolutely. A nice lead in. My grandfather of blessed memory and Rabbi Jacobs were friends. They were pals. And my grandfather was the rabbi in Glasgow. My grandfather was a bit older. So when I was coming through the Jewish Theological Seminary, a lot of us had student pulpits. And at the time, the arm of the men's programming of the conservative movement, something called the FJMC, the men's clubs, were sponsoring rabbinical students to go out to seed communities around. And so, Eddie, you might recall my last 2 years of rabbinical school, once a month, crazy as it sounds now, I flew out to London to serve a community that was the late 90s. Right. And I helped seed a community in St. Albans. The conservative movement in England is called the Masorti movement. And to my great joy, they eventually hired a full-time rabbi, and the community to this day is flourishing. The chief intellectual and organizational leader was Louis Jacobs at the time of UK Jewry. So that was my first actual contact with Rabbi Jacobs, that I introduced myself. I'm Reverend Cosgrove's grandson. He was very warm. It was very joyful. And there was a sweetness to it. I then finished up my internship there. I graduated from JTS. I went to University of Chicago. And as I was finishing up my exams, and I was working in the area of the status of scripture of the Bible in modernity. And I thought that I was going to write the next dissertation on Martin Buber, on Mordechai Kaplan, on Abraham Joshua Heschel, a book on sort of how one of these giants of 20th century theology handled the question of the clash between traditional devotional study and critical scholarship. At which point, I'll never forget, my advisor, a great, great man and continued friend and teacher and mentor of mine, Paul Mendes Flohr, looked at me as I was sort of sitting in the library post-exams, and he said, "Elliot, you have this whole British thing going on, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, no one's ever written a dissertation or a book on Louis Jacobs." And I kind of looked at him and I said, "You know what? You're right." And he said, "You could write sort of the next book on Martin Buber, or you could be the first person to write on Louis Jacobs, a man who, as we'll probably get into, his career was entirely on this issue of the status of the Bible in the face of modernity." And so I went out that summer and the following few summers to research, to spend time with Jacobs, to interview the whole world of Anglo-Jewry. I think it was three summers total that I was in England just doing research as I was writing this document, and developed a close relationship with Louis Jacobs during that time and his family, interviewed him at length. And the sadness, of course, is that just as I was finishing up, he passed away in 2006. But then when I reconnected with Jacobs, he's a very sweet man, but there was kind of like, it's about time someone wrote a dissertation on me. And he was delighted that someone was and that I was. And even though there was a personal relationship there, he said very specifically, said, "Elliot, facts, truth, your judgment, this needs to be a critical, I don't want this to be a glamorous piece, and you need to tell it like it is." He was insistent on that, and my dissertation is not, I mean, I'm critical of him. As much as I'm appreciative of his legacy, I'm critical of his legacy as well.
So I want to learn more about the man and his contribution to Jewish life. Could you take us into Rabbi Jacobs' background and describe his career trajectory up until, say, 1960 or so?
The story of Jacobs is as much, it's part biography, it's part history, and it's part theology. And those are all interrelated, no different than in the Lower East Side of New York, how there was this mass migration of Eastern European Jewry to American shores. So too, there, you know, the great port cities of England, Liverpool, London, Manchester, otherwise, all received these immigrants, many of whom their number one agenda point was to shrug off the old world, if you will. Jacobs was part of that story. He was born in 1920. He grew up the first 12 years of his life in a very secular household. He shares stories about going to football matches on the Sabbath. He had a secular education. His family was Jewish, but not observantly so. It was a working class family, a poor family. And at the age of 12 or thereabouts, he was going to go work in one of the factories to support the family. And it was at that time that a small cheder, House of Jewish Learning, offered to educate Jacobs at that time and keep him off the streets. Jacobs spent the next few years of his life in that cheder, and he quickly, the world discovered that they had on their hands an ilui, And Eloy is a word for a genius. Jacob's had honest to God photographic memory. What he read, he remembered, and he could recite. And it wasn't just that he was someone who remembered everything. He could assimilate the information and integrate the information. And he quickly, from this sort of modest secular background, rose up to the ranks of entering the Manchester Yeshiva, which was a great Eastern European house of learning that had sort of been transplanted from Eastern Europe to the city of Manchester, where he was living. And then from that yeshiva, he even distinguished himself there and went on to study somewhere called the Gateshead Kollel, which, if you can imagine, sort of a finishing school for the best of the best, the top gun of the yeshiva world. Jacob's again distinguished himself there. And so that got us to this incredible moment of British Jewry, because now we're in the late 30s. You have Jacob's rising up the ranks. You have his secular background on the one hand. You have the Eastern European influences of the Master Manchester Yeshiva. You also have Central European Jewry all fleeing in a refugee status when the storm clouds over Hitler's Germany and Europe were gathering. And Jacob's, in sort of this Where's Waldo fashion, was studying with the best of these refugees at the time. And it was also a moment of intellectual ferment that the organizations, the Chalutz movement, pre-state of, in Hebrew the word is hachshara, preparation for immigration to Israel, was happening in England, that would-be future kibbutzniks were being trained, educated at the time. And so all of these streams were all present in Manchester in that late 30s, early 40s moment, when, of course, we know horrific things were happening in Europe at the time. Jacobs decided, though there were pressures for him to become a full-time yeshiva student, something about him, maybe his secular background, maybe just his ambition, he wanted to get a PhD, a doctorate. And he went to University College London, and he worked on a degree in Semitics with a man named Siegfried Stein. And I bring that up not just because it's his biography, but that was a moment that, again, he was being introduced to another form of scholarship in the hands of an academic refugee, but he was also being exposed to a model. Stein was someone who was punctilious in his observance. He was a frum, very religious human being, religious Jew, but he grappled with all of the difficult scholarly questions. He was a guy who wrote the article that the Passover Seder wasn't originally a rabbinic invention, but it was based on Roman symposia, right? The four cups of wine, et cetera, et cetera. So he was a scholar in every sense of the word, but Stein bifurcated his world of scholarship and religiosity. And something in Jacob's mind said, that ain't right. It's impossible to have your scholarship and your religious life exist in these hermetically sealed containers. And he wrestled, and he was on a quest to seek a synthetic vision. And so from there, he got his PhD. And this is where sort of, as I was writing the dissertation, I couldn't help but sort of ask myself certain self-reflective questions. As he was writing his PhD, working part-time in a synagogue in London, before he got his first big job, which was to be the rabbi of Manchester's Central Synagogue, that I saw elements of his journey in my journey, though I'm a much watered-down version of Jacob's. And then, of course, in 1954, Jacob's was the rising star, if you will, of British Jewry, and he took a post at something called the New West End Synagogue, which again, and I want to be very delicate of how I say this, but it was sort of the aristocracy of British Jewry prayed there.
And that was an Orthodox synagogue.
That was an Orthodox synagogue, but it was a synagogue that by many in the Orthodox world was seen as beyond the bounds of traditional orthodoxy, meaning their own observance of Jewish law, the presence of a choir, of other sort of progressive steps that maybe a liberal American Jew wouldn't consider to be progressive. But I have a letter from one of his teachers, Rabbi Monk, who sort of was this great representative of German Jewry orthodoxy, castigated Jacobs when he heard that Jacobs was going to take the job at the New West End, because he was like, how can he do that? We all know that the New West End is treif, is not kosher. But Jacobs was still an Orthodox rabbi, and the important thing to note, Eddie, is that Jacobs was asking questions about the integration of faith and scholarship long before the late 1950s.
So I'd like to play some audio of Rabbi Jacobs himself. This was filmed late in his life. I'm sure you've seen this video. In this video, he's giving brief summaries of every single book he ever wrote, some 50 titles to his credit. And in this segment, he gives a brief discussion of his book, We Have Reason to Believe.
The trouble began when I published what has now become my notorious book, We Have Reason to Believe. There's not much point at this late stage in rehearsing the whole story. The book was published in 1957, and I'd been at the New West End 3 years. The book was a series of lectures, or based on a series of lectures I gave at the study group to very intelligent men and women, chiefly young people, at the New West End Synagogue. And on the whole, the book discussing theological topics was, I thought, quite orthodox.
So he describes this book derived from a collection of lectures he gave on Jewish topics relating to faith, Torah study, and scholarship. Yet he said at the beginning this was considered notorious. So can you take us behind the scenes here of the story behind We Have Reason to Believe and how that affected his career trajectory?
Here's where I think I would take issue with Rabbi Jacobs' characterization with the story. It is indeed true that his 1957 publication, We Have Reason to Believe, was the epicenter of the controversy of the what's known in retrospect as a Jacobs affair. But the truth of the matter is that when his publication, We Have Reason to Believe, came out in 1957, which was the result of these adult ed lectures that he gave, it came and went without a whimper. There was actually a very disappointing first run of the publication. It was not some sort of earth-shattering event, period. Now, I do want to say that as an Orthodox rabbi, what Jacobs was seeking to do in that book, and here I do think he is being honest, is he was trying to give a defense of orthodoxy in the face of the counterclaims to traditional belief and practice of how a religious Jew can straddle both this world and the world of devotional learning and observance. But the controversy actually began in 1959. Been a while since I wrote the dissertation, so if I have a date off, you'll excuse me. The longtime dean of the training ground, the JTS, if you will, of the UK, a man named Isidore Epstein, was going to retire a couple years. I think he had just announced that by 62 he was going to retire.
This is at Jews College?
At Jews College, exactly. And there was a perceived brain drain of British talent, a great scholar and teacher of Jacobs, Alexander Altman, had just left for the recently established Brandeis University. There was a sense that the Jewish community was going to lose its scholars either to Israel or to America. And at the time, one of the best parts about writing this was the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, another Louis Finkelstein, was actively courting Louis Jacobs to come join the faculty of the Jewish Theological Seminary. So Jacobs had many suitors. There was anxiety in the British Jewish community, and a few well-heeled and well-connected figures of the New West End conspired to give Jacobs a position as tutor, which is a fancy way of saying a teacher, an educator, at Jews College. And the thing that no one knows or has any written record of was the promise that upon Epstein's retirement, he would be able to become principal, which means like the chancellor of Jews College. And Jacobs did that. Jacobs left the most prestigious pulpit of all of the British Empire in order to become a tutor at Jews College, which he did for a couple of years. And he wrote and he taught. And when Epstein retired, now we're in 62, and the job was to be Jacobs, the establishment, the Orthodox establishment, blocked Jacobs' appointment as principal because a chief rabbi, Rabbi Brody, had to approve whoever was going to be the principal of Jews College. You also need to know that Rabbi Brody, everyone knew, was going to retire in 1965. And so Jacobs was perceived to be the leading candidate, potentially, to be the chief rabbi of all of the UK. He would serve for 3 years as principal and then take the job as the chief rabbi.
So the Jews College principal was considered a stepping stone to the British chief rabbi.
Exactly. And so now, whether or not Jacobs had this ambition, only Jacobs knows. But the book, How Did We Get Here? Because We Have Reason to Believe, was then held up by the Central European, Eastern European rabbinate as proof positive that Jacobs was treif, was not a kosher candidate, because even though he wrote the book as a defense of orthodoxy in the face of critical scholarship, it was read as that he had given away too much to modernity and had lost his bona fides as a card-carrying Orthodox rabbi.
So they didn't consider him Orthodox enough.
Correct. And so in 1962 was chapter one of the Jacobs affair, when his elevation to become principal of Jews College was denied. And Jacobs made all of the Jewish papers. There was an article about it in secular papers. It became a cause celeb in British Jewry and in Britain as a whole, of this sort of theological crisis in the British Jewish community. Arguably, the bigger moment was in 1964, 2 years later. In the interim, New West End had hired another rabbi, a terrific rabbi named Chaim Perl. Chaim Perl served the New West End for a few years with distinction, but then he went to America, and the pulpit came open again. Perl was now in Riverdale, where he served for the rest of his career, and Jacobs wanted his own pulpit back. And Brody at the time would not let Jacobs take that pulpit back. At that point, the entire board of the New West End resigned in protest of the chief rabbi's decision. That was the second Jacobs affair. Jacobs and his followers then established a new synagogue called the New London Synagogue, where Jacobs served with distinction until his death. And he had a long, successful career from the mid-1960s onwards as a scholar, as a pulpit rabbi, all the way through.
In founding the new London synagogue, he also created the Masorti movement, the counterpart to the conservative movement in England.
He did and he didn't.
I see.
So he did, in the sense that if you were to ask anyone who's the intellectual, ideological head of Masorti, the conservative movement in the UK, they would probably identify Louis Jacobs. The truth of the matter is, I don't think Jacobs saw himself as a movement man. I think he felt to his dying day that he hadn't left Orthodoxy, but Orthodoxy had left him. Remember, we began talking with discussion about my grandfather. My grandfather was reverend. He wore a cleric's collar. If you were to see him on a subway right now, you would think he's a priest. The rabbinate under the prior chief rabbi, a man named Joseph Hertz, it was a genteel, aristocratic, moderate sort of orthodoxy that we would now probably identify as sort of the right wing of conservative Judaism or the left wing of orthodoxy. That was the orthodoxy that Jacobs identified with. When Central and Eastern European Jewry got settled in to the UK, there was a swing right in the power structure. The rabbinical courts, called a Beit Din, they became occupied by this sort of more severe expression of orthodoxy that frowned on Jacobs and what he represented. And so I think it's a little disingenuous, but I think that Jacobs would, to his dying day, would say he didn't mean to be the founder of another movement, but his movement, Orthodoxy, left him.
I wanted to touch up on one thing. So when he was considered by Rabbi Brody to be too treif, so to speak, unkosher for traditional orthodoxy, what was the theological point that Brody was seizing upon in We Have Reason to Believe to take that action that he did?
So the point was the issue of Torah Misinai in Hebrew, the divine status of Scripture, that in an orthodox framework, one believes either that God gave the Torah to Moses, or Moses transcribed the Torah from God, however you choose to understand it, but that it is the word of God. And Jacobs, you know, given what he knew about critical scholarship, about source criticism and who wrote the Bible and when the Bible was written, he knew that divinity of the Torah couldn't be reliant solely on a question of its origins. A great philosopher Jacobs quotes is a man named William James, and James made a distinction between the root and the fruit of a text. The root is that we believe something is holy because of where it comes from. The fruit is that we believe something is holy because of its effects on the practitioner. Jacobs believed that the Torah was holy by way of its effect on the observant Jew. And so that, which makes eminent sense to me, was a step too far for orthodoxy, you know, if you understand the status of the Bible as both a narrative and as a book of legislation, to be rooted in its divine origins.
I remember when I was at JTS, I went there as an undergrad, and I took my first introduction to Jewish theology with the late Rabbi Neil Gilman of blessed memory. Rabbi Gilman assigned works by Rabbi Jacob. Rabbi Jacobs, among his many publications, wrote a book called A Jewish Theology. And I remember Rabbi Gilman singing the praise of Rabbi Jacobs because, as I remember Rabbi Gilman telling it, Rabbi Jacobs simultaneously was a prodigious scholar, publishing one book after another, while at the same time he ministered to a community. He was a synagogue rabbi. He visited congregants in the hospital. He presided at funerals and weddings. He was the minister of a congregation. So I'd like to ask if you could reflect on the significance of Rabbi Jacobs playing this dual role as a scholar rabbi. It was unusual then, and may be unusual now.
You have to realize Jacobs was hands down the top mind of his day. There was nothing Jewish that was foreign to him. He had written on Jewish mysticism, on Talmudic logic, on biblical criticism, on halachic development. His retentive memory and his creative thought, he was in a class of his own. Had he have just sat in a library, Carol, and written books of scholarship, he would have cast a huge shadow over 20th century Jewish scholarship. He also did weddings.
He loved Judaism and he loved the Jews.
He loved Judaism and he loved Jews. And I think that really comes out in his scholarship. You know, the word popular has a pejorative sort of connotation in our usage that we say, oh, well, he's a popular educator. For Jacobs, popular was a badge of pride because he wanted his scholarship to be accessible and impactful on what he called the Jew in the pew. He would even go so far as to say, I'm that guy, right? He remembered his origins of this sort of secular football-playing Manchester kid. He always taught and preached, never forgetting sort of the secular and possibly alienated place of the Jews that he served, and he sought to rope them in. And he did so with a modesty and a simplicity of language, right? You can get caught up if you're reading Hermann Cohen, Franz Rosenzweig, all the existentialists, I need a thesaurus to understand what they're saying, one to the other, to the next, you know, it's confusing stuff. Jacobs, you can read. He understands. One paragraph leads into the next. There's an ease of, he says what he wants to say, and then he puts down his pen. And, you know, he had this great language, you know, he said, you don't have to be fat to drive fat oxen. There's a difference between being simplistic and stating things simply. And he was a theological educator in the best sense of the word.
I want to turn to the present for a moment, put Rabbi Jacobs' legacy to the side, but I'm going to pull him back in a moment. For several months, our lives have been upended by the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdown that we've all been experiencing. Parenthetically, it's allowed me to worship for many services at Park Avenue Synagogue, even though I live in Florida. So I thank you for making that service available via the internet. So we've had this surreal experience of the COVID-19 lockdown. And we're also experiencing right now, we're recording this in mid-June, there's recently been much unrest in our country due to the George Floyd murder and our nationwide reckoning with racial inequality. Amidst all this in New York City, how is your congregation and community doing? And how are you managing to minister to the needs of your community during this momentous time?
Eddie, that's not a fair ball question in the last 10 minutes of, so let me try to do it very quickly because I could speak for hours about it. I have to tell you what a pleasure it's been just to talk about Louis Jacobs. It's been sort of a sanctuary of my day job right now, because you're right. We're living in a world that none of us planned for, predicted. The world is facing a crisis, and not even to mention the events of the last few weeks in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. Look, institutionally, my synagogue, like any synagogue, has had to go virtual. We have our services online. We've our schools, our adult learning, all our goods and services, literal and figurative, have turned virtual. As a Manhattan synagogue, the pastoral needs have been particularly acute. We're in June right now, but I will tell you, Eddie, in March and April, I've never had a couple of months like that. You saw the numbers, we all did, of what was taking place in New York, COVID-related deaths, as well as what I would say COVID-adjacent, the elderly, the infirm, the hospitals that were overloaded, you know, saying the deathbed prayers over the phone because you can't go in, and families saying goodbye one to the other without being in the physical presence of their loved ones. I've never experience anything like that, both in volume and intensity in my career. And then So then you have the funerals themselves where you're standing graveside and that you can't go out to the grave until the grave diggers give you the green light to do so. You can't shovel earth because shoveling requires passing a shovel from one to the next to the next. You're given your 15 minutes. You got to get back in the car and then you have a Zoom show. I mean, things, Eddie, that you and I never imagined when we were training to be rabbis. And it's, thank God, that has eased in the last month. So we're operating in a virtual world. That the affirming thing is, I say this not in the need for a happy ending, but just because you asked, the affirming thing is that the case for faith and religion, I think, has never been stronger. In a time of uncertainty and people, you know, a class that I teach at 8 a.m. that normally gets only, you know, 10 people now has 60 people. People live streaming at numbers that I never imagined. People are connecting. They want ritual. They want stability. And it's not because they have time on their hands. It's because with so much uncertainty, to be able to connect to community and to tradition is a language that speaks to people in this moment. And so that has made the work you and I and other faith leaders as important as ever.
You mentioned earlier at the beginning of your career, you set out to write your dissertation on the life and work of Rabbi Jacobs. And you noted back then sort of the interesting confluence that you had similar career paths with a foot in the academic world and a foot in the pastoral world. As we celebrate the centennial of Rabbi Jacobs and your community at this momentous time, how are you drawing on the wisdom and the meaning of Rabbi Jacobs' life at this time to guide you now and in the years to come?
On the purest level, I think Jacobs was someone who was able to serve his community in good times and in bad and die at a ripe old age, loved by those whom he served and loved by his family, his children, and grandchildren. He's a model of a congregational rabbi. And if that's what one time people say about me, that I cared for my community, I brought them closer to tradition, and I modeled a spiritual and intellectual integrity, and I left the Jewish world a little bit stronger for my labors, I would take it. And so I think intellectually there's a lot more to say, whether or not the model of Jacobs and those questions about balancing scholarship and faith still animate the Jewish world as they once did. I don't think they do. I think in a way there are elements of Jacobs who, you know, he's a timepiece. He's a reflection of the world that produced him. The controversy surrounding him reflected the tectonic shifts in British society at the time. I think if we have reason to believe were to be written right now, it wouldn't make sense. But I think that model of Menschlichkeit, of intellectual integrity and deep scholarship and love of every Jew and every human being, those are never out of fashion.
As we arc towards a conclusion, I'm wondering if there are any additional comments you wish to make about the state of the Jewish community, our society, and our path forward during uncertain times.
I'll build on my last answer. I think if Jacobs were to be living at this moment, he would insist on asking the question of what changes and what stays the same. And I think that we are living through a moment. Some people are using the language of disruption. Some people are using the language of acceleration. But Jacobs was a deeply religious man committed to passing the tradition one generation to the next, but also eyes wide open to the turning of the historical clock. The changes that we're bearing witness to right now are not changes happening in slow motion. They're happening in real time. And so I think those who are invested in the Jewish future need to be able to pivot very quickly at this time to imagine a different normal, to allow for change or a hybrid new normal. And I think those are the questions that Jacobs would be insistent on asking, and those are the questions I think we need to be insistent on asking.
Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove, you are a great friend, and you are also my teacher, and I thank you for coming on the podcast to be my teacher, our community's teacher. I offer you my blessing for courage and strength going forward during these uncertain times as you guide your community and the Jewish people as a whole, and I pray that you will go from strength to strength. God bless you, and thank you for all that you do.
Eddie, God bless you, and I'm honored to be part of this, and I wish you success and strength in all that you do.
Thank you. I wish to thank my guest, Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove, for joining me on the My Teacher podcast. I invite you to look at the show notes, where you can find links to works by Rabbi Cosgrove, as well as resources to learn more about the life and work of the late Rabbi Louis Jacobs. After this outro, keep listening for a bonus clip of Rabbi Cosgrove addressing an interfaith gathering with Pope Francis at the 9/11 Memorial in 2015. I wish to thank some special teachers of mine, my three children, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Theme music is by Sam Bernstein, who is also our sound engineer. Production assistant is Noam Bernstein. Internet art and graphic design are by Esther Bernstein. Please help others find the show by rating and reviewing the show on iTunes. I welcome comments, including suggestions for future guests, at myteacherpodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach out through Twitter @podcastteach, as well as Facebook and Instagram. May the wisdom of your teachers guide you, and may you be a teacher to others.
The Book of Psalms teaches us that we should be Ohev Shalom Verodef Shalom. We should love peace, and we should pursue peace. Let us honor those killed in this place by becoming, in the words of St. Francis, instruments of peace. Where there is hatred, let us sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. So let us learn to share this big apple we all call home, in all of its diversity and all of its flavor. Through friendship and dialogue, may the timbre and tonality of each of our faith traditions be heard in this great symphony of our city and nation. On this, the historic anniversary of Nostra Aetate, let us celebrate, affirm, and build on our shared commitment to interreligious dialogue. In the words of Pope Francis, may we respect and love one another as brothers and sisters. May we learn to understand the sufferings of others. May we live to see the day, as envisioned by the prophet Micah, Ve'yashvu ish tachat gafno v'tachat teinato v'ein macharid. Everyone will sit under their own vine and under their own fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid, for the Lord Almighty has spoken.
Comfort and console us, strength us in hope, and give us the wisdom and courage to work tirelessly for a world where true peace and love reign among nations and in the hearts of all.
Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.